Welcome back to the Thermodad Podcast. I'm your host, Jayden Miller, and today I have on the podcast Mr. Keith Littlewood. So this is the second or third time that I've had Keith on the podcast, and again, it's another great episode. This one, we talk a little bit about what Keith is into currently. So he's getting his PhD right now and some of the research that he's working on. We talk about different aspects of metabolism and longevity and a whole bunch of other stuff. So make sure to put your thinking cap on this one. Make sure to open your ears up and listen intently because he's coming at you with a bunch of info on this one. So let's dive in. How's it going today, guys? I am back for another podcast episode with Mr. Keith Littlewood. How are you doing today, Keith?
Not too bad. I'm a little bit nasally. I had some cheese and I didn't realize there was some like microbial rennet in it. And I seemed to react to that. So I'm a bit nasally and histamine-y. So excuse me if I sound a bit foghorny.
Definitely. So for the guests who might not know or who are listening who might not know who you are, do you mind kind of giving them a brief overview of where you're coming from?
Sure. My background, I worked as a trainer, mainly in rehab for a number of years and had my own PT company and stuff. But and I was kind of doing that up until, 2020, but also the last 10 years I've been exploring the, role of hormones and energy and biology. I was kind of motivated by the works of kind of Ray Peet and others after, looking at things like functional medicine and lab testing and perhaps looked at how I was working with people. 15 years ago, I was recommending low-carb paleo diets to people and making people reasonably thin, but messing up aspects of function in the process. So I think over the last 10 years, I've kind of got my head more into hormones. I completed a master's degree a couple of years ago in endocrinology and currently just about to start my PhD in biosciences, which is, again, looking at hormones and particularly the role of certain pollutants to inhibit thyroid function, which I have quite a keen interest in.
That's awesome. So is that what you're looking into specifically?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to look at a couple of different pollutants and see if you can rescue function, primarily at the receptor level, by applying these pollutants. Because what most people may or may not understand is that when you go to the doctors and you have a thyroid issue, they'll typically, if you do have that, if they've managed to diagnose you from the blood test, which are problematic, they'll apply a standard hormone called levothyroxine, which is a synthetic T4. Now, when you're dealing with pollutants, as an example, is that that can inhibit how they bind to certain receptors and affect feedback. And we'll talk about how they can, change the set point of certain hormones. And so I'm interested to, if we apply a different strategy of perhaps T4 and T3 compared to a standalone T4, can we get better results and perhaps rescue the dysfunction that we see? So that's kind of what I'm trying to look to do. And there are various nuances in that where I don't know how it's going to go yet. So it's interesting. I'm challenging my bias and hopefully looking at changing the way that people are diagnosed and treated. So let's see what happens, but it's a costly affair.
Definitely, yeah. So whenever it comes to thyroid administration in Dubai or over in Europe versus the US, do you know how those are differentiated?
Well, I work with clients around the world and some places, I take Australia as an example, and certainly people that I've worked with over here in the past in the Middle East, is it still, there are still a very large percentage of clinicians, doctors, practitioners, those in the functional medicine or perhaps holistic nutrition, that will just look at TSH as a driving value. There are more and more people that tend to look at T4, T3, or even the free, most clinicians will look at the free version, but the total thyroid hormones are just as useful for coming to a better diagnosis. And a lot of people still just ignore the clinical presentation, lethargy, fatigue, weight gain, weight loss, poor sleep, altered fertility. People tend to ignore that because they have this gold standard test of the, say, thyroid stimulating hormone that some people believe is foolproof, but there are many reasons why it's not. And certainly when you start to look at the effects of pollution, how it alters set points in utero, how it kind of changes how many thyroid hormones are being produced, how they interact with the receptor, how they affect the negative feedback loops. Not enough clinicians understand that, and they just go by this blood test. And that's why I think you see more and more people being handed out single source medications or single action medications like antihypertensives, glucose medication, hypercholesterolemia and statins. You know, it's very, very common that you could argue and be a conspiracy theorist and say, well, that's just the way the system's set up. And I would be inclined to agree because that's where the money is. And not many people want to change that. And that's part of the reason why I want to challenge that with my research.
That's awesome. So one of the things that you talk really well on is longevity. And for those of you listening, if you haven't checked out Keith's website, balancedbodymind.com, make sure to check out all of his articles and the stuff that he has on there because it's awesome. And then your Instagram is pretty good as well. Is that just Tomo Littlewood?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
T-O-M-M-O Littlewood.
Yeah, that's right.
Has all kinds of great information on there. But one of the things you talk really well on is longevity. So I was wondering if we could kind of talk a little bit about longevity and how the metabolism kind of plays a role in that.
Sure. I think we could also state with that we still don't know enough about longevity. And when you go, I'm always really interested in looking at centenarians and trying to pick stuff from the press or kind of where they've been talked about how they lived their life. And I certainly don't think it's the people that are putting themselves through these very glorified longevity schemes with huge supplement lists, fasting, you know, calorific restriction and very intense exercise regimes. I think they're the people that are actually going to go sooner than the people. And if you look at them, I think it was Ray Pete who kind of drew my attention to Jean Calment, who was a French lady who was told to stop smoking at the age of 117. And she ate up to a kilo of chocolate a week and she eventually died at 123. So, you know, there are various nuances to longevity that I still don't think we have figured out. And if you look at a lot of other ones, I've seen, you know, some ladies in the UK, she died at 114 and she attributed her longevity to drinking a big tot of whiskey every afternoon since the age of 60. So, you know, I still don't think we have it figured out. It's interesting because I was having an interaction with someone on Facebook the other day and they said, I've known five people who lived into their hundreds. And one thing that they did consistently was eat solidly throughout the day. Some of them even, one of them in particular had a snack at nighttime or when he woke up, had a snack to get himself back to sleep. And I think when it comes to longevity, I think we have to be talking about maintaining complexity and organization of structure and function. And that's when we start to see things go awry, is that when we don't have that function and structure. And I think the common notions that longevity is achieved by these very ascetic things. Look, don't get me wrong. If someone's overeating and eating an excess amount of calories, then that excessive amount of energy intake that's not being utilized is going to cause problems. Therefore, fasting and calorific restriction would obviously be useful for that person who can't control their eating, because there's nothing worse than eating too many calories, because believe it or not, when you consume too much and you can't dispose of it, you will have problems. But also the flip side of that, people go take the extreme and go, well, if I eat too much, I'm going to die early because of obesity and all of the negative changes associated with that. And then there's this kind of juxtaposition now where it's like, fasting and calorific restriction are going to extend lifespan. But, you know, what is it based on? There aren't any human studies saying that, probably for ethical reasons. But most of the research where they've drawn their comparisons is in yeast. You know, it's in fruit flies, Drosophila, certain nematodes and worms. This is where they're kind of drawing their comparisons from. And also rodents. And I posted something today about that. And again, I won't take credit for this because I think it was Ray P that drew my attention to it a few years back. It's like, if you're feeding an organism foods that contribute to the aging mechanism, and this can be a certain amount of fatty acids, and it could be an excess of saturated fatty acids, it could be an abundance of the polyunsaturated fatty acids, and we'll perhaps talk about the energy effects from consuming those later. But also, you know, things like tryptophan, methionine, cysteine, amino acids that contribute to the aging process, an excess of metals. And one of the things I saw in a standard lab chow for rodents was an abundance of soy proteins as well. So if you're giving rodents that food sources that contribute to the aging, and then you're comparing them to calorie restricted versions of that, I think it's useful to make the assumption that when you're taking away these very pro-aging foods and restrict them, then those organisms are going to live longer. Now, a lot of people will extrapolate that and the concept of slowing down metabolism because you have less reactive oxygen species and therefore less oxidative stress. And that's what a lot of people, I think, are doing, is they're saying, well, okay, well, when we calorifically restrict and when we fast, we increase something called autophagy, and we, you know, we have all these fancy words flying around about how the immune system is modulated. But what we tend to do with calorific restriction and chronic fasting, as an example, is slow down our thyroid function. So we tend to see a slowing down of function. And one of the things that's come out is a lot of people make the distinction is that when you slow down the thyroid and make someone hypothyroid, the notion is that you're producing less oxidative stress. And we know that abundance of oxidative stress, we go back to the obesity and the overconsumption, there's rampant oxidative stress. There's lots of things going on. There's, you know, issues associated with glucose signaling, sugar use, wasting of glutathione and other you know, factors associated with metabolism. But what tends to happen with that is that when we do slow thyroid down, one of the things that's coming out in the studies now is that actually there's quite a lot of oxidative stress still going on. So when we have this oxidative stress, we tend to produce something called superoxide and then superoxide dismutase. And that's where we see the wasting of glutathione. And we'll see other things going on within this low thyroid state. We'll see perhaps a breakdown of the fatty acids and also their byproducts by something called malondialdehyde. So necessarily slowing down thyroid function doesn't lead to less oxidative stress. It can actually increase the amount of oxidative stress. But also bearing in mind that the point of oxidative stress, it's there to trigger the other responses that are going on. So we produce oxidative stress. It doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing because it's part of the process of oxidative metabolism. And if we get stuck in the reductive side of metabolism, that's when we start to see issues going on. And that can happen from restriction. That can happen from abundance. There's a really nice paper that came out just 2019 that's quite interesting, because in contrast to all these studies that have been saying, hey, you know, fasting, calorie restriction does all these wonderful things, but it's actually saying, well, even mild forms of thyroid dysfunction are associated with altered pancreatic signaling, utilization of glucose, chronic oxidation of fatty acids, and this is a problem. So why are we saying that slowing down thyroid and metabolism as a factor to increase longevity? Why is that occurring? Surely there's a disconnect, because we're losing complexity and organization. We're making people colder. They can't utilize glucose efficiently. Perhaps we're seeing other factors going on as well that can lead to, you know, mitochondrial damage that might also compound the issue and make more problems. So it's nice to see papers like that coming out. And what they suggested was, there are a few mice that have been genetically altered, Ames mice, snail mice, and some of these mice often have both a lack of growth hormone and a lack of thyroid hormone. And what they've suggested is actually the lack of growth hormone that contributes to their extreme longevity compared to other rodents. And that should make quite a lot of sense to anybody who kind of understands what growth hormone is and does, because, you know, again, you take the extreme form, which is acromegaly. You know, people who take lots of anabolic steroids, you see the big bone growth. You know, the guy who was in the Bond villain, of course, forgotten his name, but that big, huge guy, you know, that's the state of acromegaly. You tend to see bigger growth strategies. So within the organs, they start to grow. And so growth hormone itself can lend itself to this kind of proliferative state, but also the states of dysfunction associated with pancreatic signaling, poor insulin responses, diabetes, and ultimately cancer. And so it shouldn't really come as a surprise that when you start to restrict growth hormone, you might start to see increased longevity in species. And so I think that's something really worth considering, because low thyroid function does lend itself to diabetes. You do see, you know, increased HbA1c values. You do see less insulin responsiveness, you know, various tests like the HOMA-IR, which is like the homeostatic mechanism of insulin regulation. These diabetic tests are the things that you see starting to creep in when thyroid function starts to decrease. You'll see hyperinsulinemia, you'll see high glucose values, and that's very common in low thyroid function. So I think when it comes to longevity, you know, maintaining metabolism, maintaining glucose responsiveness, glucose signaling, you know, all of the proteins that are associated with carbohydrate entry into the cell, keeping those, their function and their structure working, makes much more sense to me than all this, you know, this current zeitgeist of restriction. So equally, you can eat too much, but you can certainly undereat. And, you know, one of the things that's come out in some studies is that even when you refeed these people that have been fasting, their thyroid hormone receptors just aren't expressed as well as they were before.
Yeah. So that brings up quite a few questions in my mind. So one of the things is, do you mind defining what you mean whenever you say organization, structure, and complexity for the people who might not know what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I tend to jump ahead and get excited sometimes. So if we think about complexity, we could take it back to very kind of early cell types where we had anaerobic, you know, cells and aerobic cells. And the aerobic cells didn't come till much later, when the planet started to produce more oxygen. But generally, if you think about that now in your biology now, you have obviously anaerobic cells and you have aerobic cells. And the aerobic function of mitochondria has obviously taken millennia to evolve. But it's usually that kind of complex structure of using oxygen combined with your fuel stuffs or your substrates like, you know, carbohydrates and fats. This is kind of how we produce energy efficiently. Now, within that structure, you have your the aerobic system is ultimately the electron transport chain. So complexes 1 through 4 and ultimately 5, where we have the production of adenosine triphosphate, which is our energy currency, water and carbon dioxide. Now, that's efficient biology working at its best. Now, when we start to lose efficiency, we'll fall back onto less efficient mechanisms. And it might be glycolysis, and glycolysis isn't necessarily bad. And we will use glycolysis and we will fall back onto, you know, both anaerobic and aerobic forms of glycolysis. But to the extent that that becomes chronic, so we all know what we feel like when we're sprinting up the stairs or running for that train that we've missed or bus that we've missed. We know how that feels, right? It's hard to maintain. When we do intense exercise, we can only work so long anaerobically because it's inefficient. It has byproducts of perhaps lactic acid and lactate. And it's very inefficient to keep using that system because it has to go back by the liver to be recycled. And it's not efficient as using glucose and ultimately pyruvate, which goes into this aerobic system. And if that isn't maintained over time, those structures break down. And there are a number of things that can break them down. We talked about how perhaps sustaining intense exercise, we can't do that for so long without falling back onto these anaerobic mechanisms, which will increase acidity within the cell or outside the cell. Sometimes the cell can do different things depending on what the disruption is. But ultimately, There are other things like pollutants. Estrogen can disrupt this mitochondrial chain anywhere in the complexes. We can have, another example is resveratrol, which is supposed to be a metformin. That's another one. I'm digressing slightly, but, you know, all of these medical interventions or nutraceuticals that are supposed to, again, extend lifespan. But what they appear to do is, again, disrupt this organized structure and disrupt function, ultimately by breaking down the aerobic system. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely. So what are some ways that, so I guess there's two questions that kind of unfold in my mind as you speak that, like, one is, do you think that mitochondrial uncoupling would be good for that? And then what are ways do you think that we could kind of plug the mitochondria so there's less leakage for a reactive oxygen species to get through?
Well, all of the kind of mitochondrial uncouplers, you know, thyroid hormone is a key driver of the uncoupling proteins. I mean, it lends itself to optimal oxidative phosphorylation or aerobic metabolism. You know, the other things like aspirin can be useful. We've talked about methylene blue in the past, which I think is an awesome way of decreasing mitochondrial proton leak across the membrane. So that's basically how the aerobic metabolism is stimulated. And going back to the fasting again, there's a paper from 2005 by someone called, I think it's Howard Speakman or something like that, whose paper was Uncoupling to Survive. And I think that mitochondrial uncoupling does lend itself to kind of increasing metabolism function over time. Aspirin does a slightly different job sometimes because it can cause a cessation of breaking down fats as a fuel and promote better glucose oxidation. So there are a number of different things in that, whether it's methylene blue, aspirin, thyroid, even progesterone as an example, that can have an optimal effect on the mitochondria. That means perhaps less rampant oxidative stress is going on, less chronic oxidation of fatty acids is going on, and the breakdown of certainly the very unstable PUFAs and HUFAs, which, you know, relatively unstable at room temperature, and you put them in the human body, and unless there's enough vitamin E to prevent them oxidizing, they can cause rampant problems. So, you know, chronic oxidation of fatty acids is well known in the diabetic state, you know, within the diabetic heart, which is more prone to oxidizing fatty acids, but it can use glucose as well. And I think the switching, just, you know, as with kind of Randall's cycle of glucose fatty acid oxidation, there should be a relative flexibility as flipping between glucose and fatty acids as a fuel. I think to the extent that this chronic rampant fatty acid oxidation takes place, this is where we might see problems. And again, it can come down to perhaps what's going on at the perceived cell membrane wall as well. And if there's, you know, chronic oxidation of fatty acids, particularly things like DHA, you find cells losing lots of their structure. They're prone to swelling. They're prone to oxidation. They kind of create leakiness within the cell membrane, if that's the way you see it. This is where the problems that can occur. And I think being able to maintain glucose metabolism is the hallmark of organized, you know, structure and function. And when you lose that, that's the hallmark of disease.
Definitely. One of the things that I think it was Ray who said it a while back was that one of the key aspects of aging is a possible light deficiency. Do you know how light kind of plays a role in that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could argue it comes from the very simple component of vitamin D, would be one of the key mechanisms. You could argue that there's a certain amount of optimal UV light that can enhance our physiology, and that's very well known with vitamin D. And obviously we have the other spectrums like red light as an example, perhaps orange and yellow lights that fit in that certain spectrum, I think around about 6:30 to about 8:30 or 8:50, which is useful to get. And I think you see I'm actually sat under a red light here right now. So I think light deficiency is a very big issue for a lot of people. And, you know, it's generally why we see a lot of people function a lot better when they start to get more light. And light will enhance that, you know, organized structure and function by working with copper. And we talked about how these complexes of the aerobic system, and particularly at 4, we have cytochrome C and cytochrome C oxidase, which interact with this copper pigment and red light to restore that optimal aerobic function. And I think that's another key thing of being able to maintain glucose metabolism, pyruvate metabolism, and to create adequate energy, water, and ultimately carbon dioxide, which is another self-regulating factor when it comes to longevity. And again, it was Ray, I think, who probably pulled me onto the fact that people who live at altitude, you know, further away from sea level, and there's obviously a sweet spot, it's how many meters it is. I think it's probably somewhere anywhere between 1500 and 2,500 meters, I think, is probably the sweet spot, maybe a bit higher. And you certainly see, I actually thought I might be able to comment on this on what it's like in say areas like Nepal. But one of the key things that people die of in Nepal are malnutrition and pollution. So it's difficult to say at the moment. So you'd have to look at perhaps other areas and demographics. But certainly getting adequate carbon dioxide is another factor that, that lends itself to maintaining structure and function.
So I actually have a theory that I've thought about whenever it's in regards to the elevation and the reductive state of the stress hormones. So people tend to have an affinity to reach a peak whenever they're around mountains, whether it's hiking or skiing or whatever it is. And I think that it might be due to an actual physical pulling of the ionic exchange in the earth, pulling the reductive state of the hormones lower in the body, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't have any comments on it because I've never heard of that before, but it's certainly possible. There are certainly, I mean, even if you kind of look at, say, you know, biomagnetic fields that can have a substantial impact on cellular function. I was reading, I'm digressing slightly because I can't really comment on what you were talking about. Sorry, can you just make that statement again? It was the altitude affecting the ionic.
The ionic exchange. So basically like the negative ions being exchanged with the earth, similar to like the grounding theory.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it increases the reductive state.
It decreases the reductive hormones in the body.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, and so are you saying that is there a sweet spot? Do you think that that's at?
I'm not really sure because my main thought process with it was that usually, like, we tend to see like monks that tend to live at very high elevation. They tend to live for a very long time, and I think that is due to a actual physical response to a lack of stress hormones because of that pull of the magnetism of the earth.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a possibility, and I'm sure carbon dioxide adds into that too. I'd also just add the very, very basic feature of being away from pollution. Because I think when you kind of live, I've spent the last 10 years in one of the most polluted areas in the world. I've certainly had my health issue. I've had health issues because of it that I've managed to sort out. So I feel sorry for the people that have no idea for what they're doing. But I think there are many things that can contribute to that. And I think, you know, the more you can move away from stressful environments, the more that you can kind of trigger those responses. But getting away from pollution, I think, is a key component of that. The other thing that I was going to talk about is how I think Mei Wan Ho, have you heard of her? Who wrote the book, The Rainbow and the Worm. She talks about, you know, bioelectric fields. And she was talking about, again, this would be another aspect of pollution. She was talking about how, you know, bioelectric fields and biomagnetic fields, you know, electromagnetic stress has such a capacity to alter cellular function, because we know that, you know, whether it's going back to books like The Body Electric, that there is a substantial amount of electric current that takes place within the body. And this probably ties more into the line of Gilbert Ling's work as well, is that when you go through phase transitions and you have ordered proteins within cellular structure, you know, coacervates, proteins, gelatins that are structured with organized water. Perhaps what ties into what you're saying as well is that when you're not exposed to these features, and again, being away from polluted cities and for, you know, cities that have strong electric and electromagnetic fields around them, would create a certain amount of distress that would lend itself to disordered proteins, protein folding, structures to cells going wrong. So we start to see, you know, anything from ion levels in and outside of the cell being altered, which would lend itself into kind of, you know, the stress that you might see as soon as that starts going wrong. Then you start to see many other things going wrong. You start to see serotonin increase. Will have stimulatory effects on the adrenals, and this is where we might start to see all those kind of reductive and long-term stress hormone responses that would play a role. And I think there are probably many things that would drive that response, whether it's in the city, but moving away to those perhaps higher altitudes has many different levels.
Interesting. So how big of a role do you think that the psychological part of the individual plays? Because one of the things that I've seen with these people who tend to live for a very long time is they're relatively free of psychological stress in many cases.
Right. I think it's super important. And I think it's all about perception more than anything else. And that probably ties into many different tenets. It could come from inheritance. You could get some form of inheritable traits. You know, you could even draw on the components of transgenerational stress. And I was speaking to a friend the other day who often feels that there's kind of even war trauma coming from previous generations that are influencing, you know, offspring's birth. And we know that pollutants play a key role in transgenerational offspring effects, you know, whether it's the role of metformin on influencing testicular and ovarian size within offspring, you know, that happens in a single line. What are the components of kind of long-term, say, stress that someone's experienced on a cell line over many, you know, many generations? And when you combine that in with pollution as well, the ability to perhaps react and operate with your own free mindset is very much restricted, because you have all these stresses that lend to a depleted energetic state. They also have a key role on hormones like thyroid, which we know has a key effect on anxiety and depression. And so to the extent that someone A, inherits good traits from their parents, which we know good and bad stuff can be passed on, the type of environment that they're raised in as well will have a key thing, their nutritional components, the stresses that we've talked about already. And that will put you in a situation where you're able to perceive stress as positive or negative, right? So how you formulate your, some people look at it from a mathematical perspective, which is beyond me, but I understand the components of boundary conditions that create our interaction with the environment. And when they aren't favorable, we tend to not respond very well. And I think if you come back to the kind of tenets of what health are, which is physical, chemical, and emotional, or limbic, then all of these three components can be out and your ability to deal with those situations becomes suboptimal.
Definitely. So what do you think are some of the most actionable steps that somebody could take on a day-to-day basis in order to promote as much stress-free and longevity-friendly life as possible?
I think it depends on the person. I mean, you see a lot of people doing meditation and grounding and being present with stuff. I don't do that, because when I go for a walk in the morning, for an example, I'm looking at the trees, I'm looking at what birds are out. I kind of try and connect with nature, which I think is a really big component for a lot of people. Now, at the moment, I'm sandwiched between two 5G tower masts. Thankfully I'm moving out of that, but you know, even when I go for a walk in the morning, I'm trying to set myself for being relatively connected with all the other things around me. So I think getting into nature is a very key component for health. If we stare at gray walls and, you know, tube subways or kind of, you know, big highways of cars and stuff, I think that can disconnect us with the process of life around us. So I think having an appreciation of nature, and if you do live, you know, some people don't have the capacity to get into nature, whether at social or economic status, but if you have the capacity to get to a park or travel just outside of the city, I think spending time in nature is a very, very key component for emotional health or spiritual health, or just feeling connected with the earth as a whole. I think that's one. And I think the obvious components of eating good quality food, devoid of plenty of the pesticides that we know inhibit thyroid function and other aspects of hormone function, which we see very, very negative effects from. People talk about glyphosate, and some people say it's been disproven. When you look at the abundance of research and you see all the studies of how glyphosate, carbamates, and other well-known pollutants affect our food, you'll get a pretty good idea of how these foods not only creep into our physiology, that they take quite a long time to disperse. And in some cases, they don't disperse at all. So, you know, understanding not just what goes into your body from a nutrition perspective, being aware of the hormones or hormone disrupting agents around your home, whether it's from Teflon and the perfluoroalkyls that you find in, say, you know, your kind of nonstick pans. These are things that you need to be aware of. So I'll just roll that back a bit. So you have the nutrition. I think eating foods that support metabolic function. I think being aware of your environment at home, you know, the type of chemicals or things that are going on. Being aware of the environment outside of your home, I think, is very, very important. Being able to kind of understand that your home needs to be a cocoon that you need to regenerate in. You know, for me, because I live in a very polluted city at the moment, you know, I have air filters in the major rooms. We try to avoid using any harsh cleaning products of any kind. And so, you know, I think having an understanding of the commercial and industrial pollutants that tend to populate our houses is pretty important. Sometimes when we go out into the big wide world, there's not much that we can do. And that kind of leads me on to the next point, is that maintaining thyroid function or using kind of adaptive compounds to enhance those responses can be very, very useful for being more robust against the very degrading stimulus of the environment outside that we don't often have the capacity to change. And that's why I'm looking at the study that I'm doing, is that if we give someone adequate T3 over just a T4, can that overcome some of the obstacles that we might face in the environment, whether that's kind of, you know, combustible pollutants, whether it's some of the pesticides that we're exposed to. And if you think about that cocktail, you know, eating foods with lots of pesticides in, breathing air that has many kind of degrading qualities to it, you know, diesel fumes, other polycyclic hydrocarbons that can break down the function of the cell, the plastics that we're exposed to. If we give someone adequate thyroid hormone or perhaps adaptive substances, can that maintain a robust response? And I always love the quote by Ray Peet, who said, once your thyroid's working, you can think about anything the way you want to, which I think is a great quote, is that when you have good function and structure, which we talked about, you have good cognitive processes, you're able to interpret things, and that great line from On the Back of a Tiger, think, perceive, act, is a great way of looking at that, or perceive, think, act, sorry. I can't remember which one it is, but you know what I mean. But it's those features of being able to look at something and make up your own mind rather than kind of following what people think. And that kind of ties into the narrative with what we see what's going on globally at the moment, is a lot of people are just following things willy-nilly, and we're starting to see very clear problems come from that, whether it's kind of side effects from interventions or, you know, restricting people's livelihoods. I think there are too many people just following what they're being told and spouted and following it verbatim rather than actually questioning the very clear motives from big opportunistic businesses that have a very large history and well-documented criminal activity. So when you think about, you tie that up together about, you know, a lot of people don't question those things because, you know, they're not in touch with kind of natural processes around them. They're not eating good foods. Their thyroid hormone isn't working effectively. We see a lot of the other negative responses occurring. And what's really interesting from a pollutant perspective is what they actually do is they send that T3 just gets broken down at the liver and excreted out in the urine because that sometimes the receptors aren't being expressed efficiently. Sometimes they're increased substantially to cope with a low thyroid, and then they stop being expressed at all, or not at all, but in a very, very subdued amount. And we often see that a lot of these thyroid hormones go through phases of detoxification in the liver. One's called glucuronidation, one's called sulfation. And it basically just degrades T3 to get it rid of the body. And we can understand that if we don't have enough thyroid hormone, certainly our ability to process and interpret situations is substantially decreased. So there are three main ones that I can think of. And the other thing would be kind of getting adequate sleep. And again, that's thyroid hormone dependent. That's dependent on how much gastrointestinal inflammation that you have. So I think there would be my four main points right now. I'm sure there'll be others that I could roll off at some point as well.
Definitely. That's awesome. So like, what does an average day look like for you whenever you're kind of going throughout your day and keeping some of these principles in mind?
Well, let's just say the last 18 months haven't been my usual. I've had to change substantially. And even this year, it's been difficult for us because my wife has a very flexible job. My job is very flexible and my wife's is not. So I work with people online. So we get up and usually drop the kids off to school. We're up at 6 o'clock, dropping the kids off at school at 7:30. And then I kind of go for a walk. I'm trying to switch it around now. I try and look at research first thing in the morning when my brain's sharpest, and then I kind of start working with clients and looking at client notes and, you know, answering emails and sending off lessons and stuff like that. And then at the moment, it's Ramadan over here, so kids' school is finishing at 1:30. So it's a stressful time again. And we've had Easter holidays, we've had half term, we've had kids being sent home from school because somebody's tested positive. We had the school not open for 2 weeks at the beginning of the year. So this year is not ideal. So I do have some strategies in place of going for a walk every day, you know, taking magnesium baths, breathing, doing some carbon dioxide breathing into bags every now and then, maintaining my thyroid and getting light exposure is the big things that I try and focus on every day. And we have an abundance of sunshine here, and we're getting to a point soon where, you know, it goes above 45 degrees, so you can only go out at certain times of the day. Awesome. But I'm moving to Singapore in a couple of months, so still humid, but lots of greenery and the air's a bit cleaner.
Why did you choose Singapore?
Wife's job.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. Singapore has been on my list to visit for quite a while now.
It was good because the kids and I were checking out fruits that are grown in Singapore, and there's an abundance of really good fruits like longyuns, dragon fruits, papaya, lychees, and a few of the other ones out there that we are kind of favorites at the house. So it's good. Fresh fruit is great because a lot of it over here spoils very, very quickly because it's all imported, and or most of it's imported, and the heat tends to kind of push it bad very quickly.
Very cool. Well, Keith, I want to be respectful of your time. I know it's pretty late over there. Where can people find you? I know I mentioned your website and your Instagram earlier. Do you just want to maybe replug those and see where else people can find you?
Yeah, there's loads of stuff on my website. I have a seminar series for people that want to know more about hormones. It's got about over 20 seminars at the moment. I'm adding all the time, which is on my website, Balanced Body Mind. If anybody ever feels the need to donate to my GoFundMe for my research, there's that on my website as well. And then there's all the stuff I put out on Instagram. And there's also coaching programs on the website for people that either want just access to material or people who want time and coaching with me to look at working on energy, digestion, sleep, hormones, mood, kind of fertility-based stuff.
Awesome. Well, for those of you listening, make sure to go check out his stuff. And Keith, talk again soon.
Hey, great to see you. Speak soon.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to hit the like button, subscribe, and leave a comment down below if you want us to cover a different topic.